You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Shout out to all my looms. Hey, what's going on out there? Whew, it's been tumultuous. Good, bad, otherwise, everything's going on all at once, all over the place. The whole globe is having a tremendous transformation. Some of the old is dying out, some of the new is coming in, and at any rate, it will all have to balance itself out. So, hey, to all my luminaries out there, before we get started, I want to give a shout out to our sponsor, Kevin Pike, Coldwell Banker, Senior Real Estate and Probate Specialist, and one of my favorites, close to my heart, Coldwell Banker, 818-571-1508. He will take care of all of your real estate needs. So let's get into today's show. Welcome back to the set. Before we start, I want to show you our guest. Let me show you when we bring it on. I'll show him at the same time. So today we have the wonderful pleasure of talking to someone who really specializes in the roots of human history, culture, civilizations. He is swollen with wisdom. And by swollen, I mean, he's just full of wisdom of what I love about him. He is a disciplined scholar that is the master of, I would say, primary firsthand research. He has numerous studies, so I don't want to go through all of them. But one of them is that he's a tenured professor at the Africana Studies at Contra Costa. And I think that's very important because not only has he earned respect and degrees and shared them, he's sharing them with the future, the people that are coming up, students, adults alike that learn from him. Let's welcome to the set, Professor Manu Empim. Hey! Welcome. How are you?
I'm great, Miss Osiris. I'm doing great. I'm here in Northern California, and I'm holding down the fort.
Yeah, well, you go ahead. I wanted to show you your name up here. What I've been doing, I'm an abstract painter, so I've been painting in the names of the guests. Can you see your name at the end? Up at the top at the end. Okay. In the rust-looking color, it says Professor Manu Empim. You know, so you are going on my canvas of fame, I would say. So let's get right into it. I wanted to ask you a question. What, and this is an important question, what is the difference between the mainstream's assumptions about Africa and cultural, that Egyptian African civilization, and the actual reality of Africa and its civilization?
Well, I appreciate the question. You know, I've been going to Africa now doing firsthand or original research since 1990. So it's been about 3.5 decades. And I go to do research on African history, African civilization, and African high level culture and contributions to the world. But when I come back here to the U.S., it's amazing that people are they're kind of interested in my work, but their questions are, can you tell me about the game parks and animals? So, well, I cannot actually. I do know about the animals because they're part of the environment, but I'm more interested in the people. So one of the great misconceptions is that that Africa is backward and somehow not a part of modern society, and that the other misconception is that African and Africans have made no contributions to the world. You know, we still have people like back in October, I interviewed a king from Ghana, West Africa.
Really?
And then after this hour interview, one of my students who was from, the Middle East, he asked a genuine question. And after we talked about kingship and the advanced African civilizations, he still asked the king, are there any, are there any cities in Africa? Are there any cities?
I mean,
after an hour interview, what did you think you were listening to? So, and this was a sincere question. So it's hard for people to understand that Africa is in many areas, highly developed. But then you have traditional rural areas where people still practice African traditional life ways. Mm-hmm. And those life ways, the people are still practicing those life ways that have given us quite a lot. For example, iron smelting and traditional methods that are still practiced today. But people in the West are cut off from this kind of high level knowledge and civilization. So this is what I'm constantly doing, and that is to teach and to challenge the gross misinformation and misunderstanding about Africa in the past, but also even modern Africa.
Wow, I love that. Now, to me, that would strike the same chord as like in this, I'll say this, United States of America, I'm being a very global thinking person. Yeah, and just like there's some backwards people up in Mississippi, Texas, Louisiana, and all these other states that are still operating on a very rural kind of routine program, it doesn't mean that they're backwards, in because some of them are the most heartfelt people you ever want to meet. But they're not necessarily in sync with technology. They may not know how to turn on the computer. They may have to hire somebody to turn it on for them. So in lieu of that, how do we protect those kinds of cultures that we don't want everybody selling out? We don't want everyone to, you know, to be on AI. We want people that are aware of AI and intelligent enough and these things to help keep it fair, help keep it good, and help keep it pure. But we also want to retain that basic parts of our foundation. How are you doing that? How can we do that together?
Well, yeah, I appreciate that question. I'll give you an example. This past summer, actually a summer of last year, I hired a film crew to join me in the most remote areas of Ethiopia, which is in East Africa. And so I've been doing primary or firsthand research in that region of Africa for quite some time, but I needed the film crew to document me documenting the history. And so there's an area in Ethiopia that is known by researchers and scholars, but not enough documentation. And the area is called Gambela.
And in how do you spell Gambela? G-A-M-B-E-L-A? Gambela?
Yeah, B-E-L-L-A. Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, go ahead.
Gambela. And Gambela is one of those super remote areas where you have groups that no scholars have visited before. And so I wanted to, so my goal in bringing the film crew is to document those indigenous groups in the Gambela area that still practice their cultural life ways.
Wow.
And what's exciting about the groups, the five main groups in Gambela, is not only do they continue to practice their cultural life ways that go back to, but these life ways, they go back to antiquity. So as a scholar, I'm able to look at the oldest of the classical African civilizations, which is ancient Kush, the Kushite civilization, see that those rituals and ceremonies and beliefs and practices from ancient Kush that originates back in antiquity are still being practiced today by the groups in Gambela. And so the documentary that I'm working on is to really show the history of Kush, which has never been fully documented. Nobody knows the origins of Kush. We know about Kush being a great civilization, but when did it start? And no scholar has delved into the area because it's not easy. It's not simple. You have to go to the most remote areas. When we finish the documentary later this year, it's going to stun people of how difficult it is to get to those areas to be able to interview the chiefs, the elders, the heroes, the spiritual leaders. And so one after another, in the interviews, they said that they were inspired by my line of questioning because no one has ever questioned them about the deep structure and deep knowledge of their life ways. So after all the interviews, one of the most rewarding experiences for me would be able to show the community and the interviewees images from 4,000 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
Of them practicing their rituals and cultures that they've never seen before. So while they've explained why they may use the ostrich feather on their head to represent someone of very high status that can only be worn in the most important rituals or ceremonies like the funeral or the transition from leadership from one chief to another or one king to another, and they can explain the details of the special bird, which is the ostrich, but they don't link it to the distant past because they're not aware of ancient Kush, but they certainly are very aware of their own practices. So when I introduce images to them, it's amazing to see elders and the community come and look at those images and to begin to explain images and paintings and reliefs that they've never seen before. So these are the most remote areas. And one of the things, Sister Osiris, that the viewers and listeners should know is that the Ethiopians that we see here in the U.S., whether it's in California or any place in North America, these are not the Ethiopians that I'm referring to. The Ethiopians that we see, they're from the north. But Gambela is in the remote areas in the south. So in these most remote areas, I mean, it is very difficult to get to those areas because they're so remote and there's no roads at all. There's, I mean, if you want to call it, there's trails. You can't call them more than trails. And during the rainy season, it's not just water, but these are like small, almost like small ponds that you're not going to get through. So we had some very difficult days to the most remote areas, but it's all rewarding. And the goal is, and the reason why my work has been so supported by the indigenous people is because not only have researchers not visited some of these communities before, but they all said in one group after another that no one has delved that deeply. So they've embraced my primary or firsthand research as if it is their own because they understand it. I'm not representing USAID. I'm not representing the U.S. government. I'm not even representing Contra Costa College, although I have great standing there, but they recognize that I'm like them. I'm a brother who's come home to help to preserve the historical legacy of their practices. And so it's like renewed energy that someone who is not currently living among them has the utmost respect for their cultural traditions and documenting it, documenting their ways and up to preserve their ways. I'm excited when I'm in the field, but that's, you know what I call it? I call it the other Ethiopia because it's the Ethiopia that we don't see and we don't know about. And you're not going to have too many NASA Geographic or BBC crews in those areas because they are super remote. And it takes a long time to drive those great distances to meet with those communities. And that's what I've been doing now for a number of years. And I'm so glad and thankful that last year I was able to pull together a professional crew to document me documenting the history of Kush to link the ancient past to the present. And so when people see these groups, they're going to be amazed. And one last thing I think I should mention is that I did not notice something right away. One of the groups in the Gambela area, one of the elders had some pants, and his pants read going down vertically the spelling of my name, M-A-N-U.
Oh, wow.
And I asked my colleague, I said, brother, ask the elder, what does that mean? Because they don't speak, you know, English. They and Mainu is from Ghana.
Yes.
So then things got hectic. The villagers came around, and I never got a full answer to that question until later. But I was actually a little bit disappointed because when I found out what M-A-N-U meant, even though that was a sign from the ancestors, that I was at the right place at the right interview in the right group. But he said it meant that it was in reference to the Manchester the soccer team in England.
Speaking of England, that's cute. That's a great story to have too, and that bonded you some sort of way. So speaking of England, you also attended Oxford University. And I want to know a little bit about your experience there. You attended and had degrees at San Francisco State University in the Department of Ethnic Studies. That's real important for people to know. And you just in general as you said, you have embraced this whole firsthand primary research. Now, when one, just because I'm an American, bless my heart, but I have the DNA of my history. Trust me when I tell you. I saw when you say you were walking, that it was very difficult to get to the remote area. In my mind, I saw these long green stalks, and I saw this mud gushed into water, not water, but gushed into it. Like you had mud and water together. So it was like, almost like, what are those things? If you get caught in it, you could drown, and it's all mud and water sucking you in, or whatever those things, cesspool, that kind of thing. And then I saw like somebody with big old boots that went all the way up to their thigh, and it switched to, oh, that's probably where they got the design of women's boots coming over their legs from the guys that go in the rural areas. But my question to you is that when you go into these areas, first of all, I know these people have to trust you. There is something they've got to feel about you. They've got to sense about you. And I want to know, when you are in those different locations, are you feeling any kind of spiritual energy? Are you seeing things? Do you have visions? Do you remember what happens to you and your crew when you interact with these people and they bring all of that energy and all of that DNA up front? What happens?
Well, you know, I've been doing it for so long that honestly, it's routine for me. So I didn't choose the mission. The mission chose me. So I've been on the path for decades, and I've been consistent over a consistent period of time, and I'm doing exactly what I have been put here to do, which is to help us recover from historical amnesia. So when I'm in those remote areas on my own dime, no fellowships or scholarships, it's not about that. It's really about me doing the work and finding a way to get it done. So I just recognize that this is a unique role that I have. But I could tell you, 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, I was the only time it really hit me is that when I was in South Sudan, not Sudan, but South Sudan, I went to a very remote area of the Bele people. And the Bele people, they knew I was going to come because they had advanced notice that I wanted to meet the community and the elders and learn about their traditional rituals and ceremonies. And one of my guides called and told him that we would be there in the morning. But we had so many things to do. We had different communities. So it wasn't until the afternoon. And when they called the Bele community back and said, we're on our way, this was well into the afternoon. And they said, good, because the community was really anxious to meet me. And when I got there, I've never seen cultural dancing like that. You talk about energetic dancing. So the community was there, leaders were there, and they stayed literally all day because they thought we would come in early morning. And as they were introducing me and giving a history of the Bele community in South Sudan, this is the first time that it actually hit me. It really hit me that, wow, this is serious.
This is serious.
And I know that I'm an ambassador, but this really had an impact. And I said that, wow, I have to really do my best to explain the significance of their community and how it links to the distant African past and how the entire region was at one point at the apex of human achievement. It is my role and goal to document this long, continuous history going back to ancient Kush. And so when they were introducing me, they gave me great gifts. They gave me special honey that people from the entire region come to get this special honey from the Bele community. They gave me jewelry, and the people one by one came up so I can get the best photo of their culture markings. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't call it scarification, because that's kind of so the culture markings, and they made sure that they, and but I recognized when they gave me the mic to speak, I recognized that I had a mission to really speak clearly and give the most impactful message in the few minutes that I had. But I've never really felt it like that. Something just hit me at that point that this is very special. And even though it was documented. You know, I had the guy recording with my camera. Mm-hmm. And, but I said, you know what? This has been an excellent time to have a professional film crew to document the entire scene, because even though the camera was showing me, giving my appreciation for helping, you know, to work with them. But I don't think that one camera could have done that, because the pan, the audience, they were looking at me. That whole thing needed to be captured. But I'm just thankful for being able to do to do the mission and have the foresight to document these remote groups in their tremendous life ways, but also know about the high level African contributions to humanity, from the origin of the modern calendar to the first book in the history of the world, to the most advanced in the original surgical text that still survive in papyrus, and to be able to see this all comes from the same general area, and not enough work and research has been done, because it's not easy. It's definitely not easy, and you're not going to get a bunch of praise either, because it's not about that. It's about doing the work that will, as I say, help us recover from the amnesia that we typically suffer from.
I wanted to know, speaking to that subject that you mentioned about artifacts, how do we protect the artifacts? Like, how do you know that some of the artifacts have been stolen? Or how do you know? Like, I think I read in some of the information you sent over, that you're worried about the region because, again, you know how greed is. Next thing you know, they're coming in, knocking down everything without any kind of connection to why it's there, the culture, the history. How do you and your crew, or you, protect that information and that civilization?
I can tell you a couple of things that I've done. One is back in 2011 when I was in Sudan, which is north of South Sudan. I was doing work at the archaeological sites, and I got word that there was a dam being built that would flood one of the most important archaeological regions in the world. And this was the Merowe Dam. It's at the fourth cataract along the Nile River in northern Sudan. Mm-hmm. So I went with my Sudanese colleague to record and document what I could before that dam was complete. And being in Sudan, I learned that there was a series of dams being constructed to flood the entire area. And the goal was allegedly to create hydroelectricity so that people would have, you know, lights. And but that was not the reason. The goal was to maximize profits at the expense of the local indigenous people. And so I said, this is such a huge project. There's no way I can do this alone with a couple colleagues in Sudan. So I came back to the U.S., actually went down to L.A., and I consulted with some colleagues, and we created the Save Nubia Project. So the Save Nubia Project was really to raise national and international awareness about the series of dams being built that would flood and was beginning to flood the areas of ancient Kush and Nubia, one of the greatest archaeological regions in the world. And we had tremendous success at popularizing what was happening. And now what has happened more recently in Sudan is a civil war has broken out. So the dam projects have stopped. Mm. But so no one can really go into the war zone now. So our project really gained a lot of awareness in different parts of the world. And so we got a lot of support to continue to document the archaeological sites, the artifacts, and the local communities that were being displaced by the tens of thousands of people being displaced. Because once the water, you know, the dam is complete, the water backs up and creates reservoirs and large lakes and floods communities, destroys areas. So this was a major task that I needed support. So we made a lot of progress with the Save Nubia Project. Now we're at a hiatus. We're on pause. Let's just see what happens with the war that's been going on since April of 2023. So that's one of the things that I was able to do. And then, you know, my book, A History of African Civilizations, which I published second edition in 2023, also does the same thing, to talk about these African civilizations that must be understood to be very significant and linked to our modern, so-called modern progress, modern society, and because there's no path other than going back to Africa, whether it's iron smelting, metallurgy, medicine, writing, the solar calendar, even the organization, the social organization where women was central to the society, you know, and having a just law, an ethical law for everyone, and 42 declarations of innocence or laws to deal with social conduct, social behavior. How do you show wisdom? How do you stay out of social conflict and so forth? You know, the whole comprehensive moral code. These are things that we gave to the world. And my work has been to record, document, and preserve this as much as possible by my book, and bringing groups every year on educational tours so they can actually see what it is that I'm seeing and documenting and has been doing so for a year. One other thing to your important question. I've started this in 1989. So when I went to Oxford University, I was excited. I was at Morgan State University, historically black college in Baltimore. And I had an opportunity to go to a Oxford University summer session in 1989. I was excited, not really about going to Oxford, but the opportunity to go to Europe, because I was aware that Europe, one country after another, had stolen many African artifacts. So I knew that if I can get to Oxford, England, then I didn't have much money. I wasn't broke. I just didn't have any money. So I learned.
I learned that. You distinguish that. That's different.
Yes, I wasn't broke. So I learned how to manage a dime. And I told people that I would be gone from anywhere from 3 months to 2 years. I didn't know how long the money could last. But I actually stayed an entire year. And I went to all the major museums, institutes, and libraries throughout Europe that have stolen African artifacts. Yes. I went to 11 countries. So I used England as a base, and then I went to East Germany and West Germany. Now they're one Germany. I went to Austria, Italy, Spain, France, Belgium, Holland, Denmark, and Sweden. And I went to large and small collections to record and document these artifacts that had been stolen from Africa. So I studied over 1 million artifacts in Europe that had been stolen without authorization before I started to do the field work in Africa itself. And so I've been, you know, writing and recording, documenting the what I call the vanishing evidence of classical African civilizations, because not only have artifacts been stolen and they still are housed in the greatest institutions throughout Europe and Europe and America and Canada, like the Metropolitan Museum in New York, the Brooklyn Museum, the Cleveland Art Museum. We can go down the list, or the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. They have tons of artifacts. University of Chicago, Oriental Institute. This is theft. So Africans now on the continent and even other countries are trying to get their artifacts back. It's part of the repatriation movement to return
our artifacts,
cultural artifacts and human remains to the rightful owners. And so I've been a part of this since my 12-month journey in Europe and back in 89 and 90. So I've been working on the preservation and expansion of the knowledge of this and why it's important since that time.
How big of a team does it take? I mean, you said you were really kind of wait, let me back up a little bit. How do you know if an artifact has been stolen, number one? And then how big of a team do you need to actually make the exhibition whole, that it makes sense, that you got the data to support the visual, that you got the visual to support the people, and et cetera? And how do they keep from being stuck in time?
Yeah, it's pretty easy to know that the artifacts are stolen because they're touted as artifacts from ancient Egypt or artifacts.
Oh,
from
Africa. Okay, so they're labeled. Okay.
Yeah, so they have whole collections. So the British Museum, they have a whole wing. You know,
stolen artifacts,
or the Louvre in Paris, they have a whole wing. Or
I've been to the Louvre, yeah.
Or the big museums in Berlin, or in Leiden, Holland.
I've been to those.
Yeah, you know, so they tout that these are stolen artifacts, and when people say we want our stuff back, the British Museum say, well, we can't give back these artifacts because it's against our laws. My question is, well, what laws were in place when you stole these in the first place? So what are you talking about? And so that's what we're up against. They know, these collections know, that if they start giving back artifacts, they won't have a collection. As, they won't have a collection. They won't even have a museum because most of this is stolen. Yeah, so that's what we're dealing with. And so it's pretty easy to track
the artifacts themselves.
Yeah, so anytime there's an exhibit that goes through the Los Angeles County Museum of Art or LACMA, or here in Northern California, the Rosicrucian Egyptian Museum, they argue, the Rosicrucians, that is, it's in San Jose, California, they argue that they have the largest authentic Egyptian collection west of the Mississippi.
Really?
So they're proud to announce
it. Do they have it?
Okay, yes and no. Here's what I would say. So they do have a sizable collection, but all of that is not original, even though they try to present it that way. So some of the artifacts are made by the hands of modern man. They're not ancient artifacts at all. So they'll have a docent, you know, someone who gives the tours through the museum that will say, well, anything you see, folks, that's behind glass is original, and if it's not behind glass, it's not. I remember I told one of the docents, I said, you need to stop saying that. That's absolutely untrue. I said, upstairs you have items behind glass that are 20th century. They look European, and these are not authentic art. You say, oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, of course I'm right. So you need to stop.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, you need to stop misrepresenting this. I said, these artifacts have been taken from Africa. You've taken all these, you've stolen these, some of these you don't even know who were the original thieves that took them from the tombs, but you bought them because you wanted to build your collection. And then you create these phony and fake modern images that look absurd, they look preposterous, they look European, and they're not original. So you need to stop saying that. And and so we have collections that all across the Western world, this is what they call culture in art, but it's based on stolen material. And Africans are not happy about it. Ethiopians are not happy. They stole. How you steal a whole obelisk and have it in Italy for generations and don't return? They stole it when the Italians occupied Ethiopia in the 1930s. Mm. And they take this great monument, ship it off to Rome. They lied once, twice, three. They continue to lie every decade. And the Ethiopians only got back this important stela or obelisk because around 2005, some lightning struck the top of it and a piece came off. And what? The Italians were worried that, this may collapse altogether. So that's when they gave it back to the Ethiopians, even after admitting that it was stolen during the war in the first place.
Oh my, all I saw, I swear you guys, I don't mean to be funny, it's not a funny, but same though, all I saw was Michael B. Jordan and Black Panther. Remember he went and took the artifact, he broke the glass, he said, give me back this ain't y'all's anyway. I was laughing so hard when you said that. This all I could see was that scene rolling in my head. But I am surprised. And this is what I've observed from experiencing different kinds of cultures and a variety of different cultures. In general, not that we are meek, but in general, we are very kind, giving, loving, warm, a warm kind of culture. We can be aggressive if we need to be, but we don't start out. We are a very heart-based culture. Every time, even in the South, and I'm from the South, even in the South, you go to someone Black's home or some white people in some cases, but I'm speaking of African, and they're right away, baby, have you eaten? You want some water? Baby, what do you need? You need to go to the bathroom. It's just like you're having an automatic mom. You don't even know the people. But that's just how welcoming it is. And so I wanted to know, when you went to these remote areas to do your research, did you have a guide, somebody to translate for you, or, you know, was there, again, I'm in entertainment, so I'm referencing things to movie and American Gangster, when Denzel Washington decided to go over and get the real, you know, the real blue magic, he said, no, I want to go where the real stuff is. He said, you want to go to the jungle? You know, he said, yeah, I want to go to the jungle. You know, there's some stuff out there, I kill you. And, you know, Roger was saying that to Grimmer Smith, was saying that to him. So I reckon it might have been the same kind of thing when you first got in there before they trusted you. How was that experience of first going, and what kind of team did you need to make it work to be able to come back?
No, I appreciate it. I've been very fortunate. I really have, whether it's in Sudan, South Sudan, Ethiopia, to really have the best guides. So you need a trusted guide who knows the area, who has the contacts, who can speak English to communicate with me, and who has contacts with the local communities where there's a guide for each community who speaks the local language and can communicate with the chiefs in the community and can also translate back into Amharic or into Dinka and then translate into English. So in many cases, I have two translators. In the most remote of the remote communities, we have two translators. Mm-hmm. Now, if the local person in these remote areas, if they can speak English, is better because it cuts, it's more direct. Mm-hmm. You know? But I've been in the areas long enough to really pick up much of what, or some of what's being said, and then the translator can fill in all of those particular details. Mm-hmm. And so just being perceptive of what they're saying and the body language, I get an idea of what they're saying, but you really need two very good translators who also can speak, at least one has to speak English, sometimes two speak English. And I can't say how fortunate I am to have trusted brothers who are like family members, who are also knowledgeable and well-connected, so that there's never an issue about if they are legitimate or trustworthy. They're more than that. But the kind of contacts we have now is really extraordinary. And that's why this can't, to be honest, this really can't be duplicated, because you just can't go in there. They're not going to trust people. And you're totally correct. They don't trust people. They have no reason to trust people unless you come highly recommended. But like in Ethiopia, for example, I'll use Ethiopia because that was more of a challenge than a couple other, some of the other countries. And it took us about maybe a year and a half to really figure out how to really gain the trust up front. Because before my colleague, he would introduce me as American, who's coming back, who's coming to interview. So in their mind, 100% of the time, they're thinking about somebody who's white.
Exactly.
They're a little bit surprised, but so then I would have to then build my own credibility. So I said, brother, this is not going to work. So now we change it. We don't mention that. So he introduced me as an African.
Your name.
Them, who's one of them. I moved away, but now I'm coming back to preserve the history. So the period of trying to build my credibility, that's gone now, because they automatically have respect. And plus, now I've been doing it a while, but they automatically have respect. So we don't have to get past, mm-hmm, am I legitimate or not? And then not only that, one of the key things that we learn, and you need the translators and you need a guide who knows the region. And, you know, and so we used to just interview the translators. But as my colleague Andu Alam in Ethiopia, he has the best description of that problem. The problem is that the guides have broken knowledge, broken information. So we don't interview the guides anymore. We only interview chiefs, kings, elders, and heroes. Mm. And the translators will translate, but we don't interview the translators because they have, as he says, they have broken knowledge. And so they don't have the depth of knowledge of the great elders. And so we've learned that over time. And so when I go to different areas, I have groups of people, including a central guide that is the person who coordinates and communicates my goals and objectives. That's okay. Look, we're going to be here for 10 days. What can we accomplish? We need to go here, here, and here.
Okay.
How many days do we need? And so the local guy who knows the area, then it's his responsibility to organize and coordinate everything. Accommodation, drivers, translators, interviewees, and put all that together. And so as we're in consultation about, okay, we need to do this. Hey, look, you know what? We need to go back to that same community because I have a few more questions based on what they said. I'm checking out my notes and my film. I need to ask the chief a few more questions. And so we do it like that. And but you always need in each area, you need many teams of people who understand the mission and who are professional and who are connected. And that's what I've been fortunate enough to do in various areas. But some areas, like in South Sudan, this is not a tourist area. So it's very difficult because you start from scratch. You don't have guides. You have to get somebody who's knowledgeable. Who's knowledgeable. He's not really a guide per se, but he can serve as a guide. But I have to tell him what's needed. We need a place to stay. We need a place to eat so everything's fine. We need this. We need that. And so that's what I've been able to do is pull together the many teams in each region. And in some areas where there is no team, to create one and go into the most remote areas. And so that's what I'm primarily informed by, is those direct experiences more than reading what somebody else had to say.
I love that you are brave to be doing all this. You must be some fire sign or some Scorpio, you know, something that's not afraid, you know, to go in there and charge ahead and get it done, you know, and not, you know, because we have to have somebody do it. Somebody has to do it. I want to know, because we're getting close to time to get out of here. How can we help? Because I'm tired of hearing, well, you know, Black folks and Africans don't get along. I get along with Africans. I do. I have many of them that are friends. Over the years, I kept wondering why I would attract people from the other countries and things like that. And when I did Ancestry.com and found out certain portions of my DNA, now I understand. I understand the connection that it does come around. Where can we find out more about the Save Nubia Project? Where can we find you? I also wanted to speak a little bit about NASA, that NASA was helping you with do some tracking on climate changes in a lot of the different areas that you've been into. When you come back, we'll have to talk more about that. But where can we find out more about your projects, your books? I'm just having a ball. This is like gold to me, just having people to talk to. They've been somewhere and done something, and then they're just talking about the regular old thing that everybody else, you know, it's just so fulfilling for me. I want you to know that I feel like I'm traveling with you, because I would definitely be doing things like that if my mission had not been called elsewhere. But I want to hear, where can we find more about what you're doing?
Man, yes. Thank you. I appreciate it. Well, one direct way is to go to a website, advancingtheresearch.org. advancingtheresearch.org, and there people can find my book for purchase, A History of African Civilizations, as well as the film documentary project on Kush. So right there on the home page at Advancing the Research, we actually have a GoFundMe campaign to help fund the documentary, which is a first in a series of documentaries, by simply going to advancingtheresearch.org. And then also people can join the email list to be informed about projects, publications. And also on the website, I list and have the educational tours to Africa that I lead each summer. So next summer, I'm going to be leading the tour to Kemet or Egypt, the 15-day tour from June 5th through the 19th. And then shortly after that will be the Ethiopia tour, going to those remote areas and also to the areas in Ethiopia with astounding growth, development, like Axum and some of the great civilizations.
Probably beyond what we can even imagine over here. They got some stuff. Yes. I mean, just looking at Dubai's architectural structures and the way their minds are so progressive. You know, again, I'm an American. I was born and raised here, but it's like it's like we got all this money, and it's like our landscape looks like something out of a cartoon book compared to when you go to some advanced. It's like going to an advanced civilization, in my opinion. But anyway, thank you so much. So where did we find you on Facebook, X? IG under the same thing, Advancing Research?
No. So for social media, it's best to go directly to Manu and Pim. That's M-A-N-U and then last name A-M-P-I-M. So on YouTube, I have a YouTube channel. Also on Facebook, I have a very large group on Facebook, also TikTok. So just look for Professor Manu and Pim, and folks can become friends. They can join the community and be up to date on the ongoing work and research, or even email me directly at manumpim@gmail.com. But certainly social media and the website advancingtheresearch.org, folks can follow my work and also support. We do need support, but I say to people, all support is welcome, but the work's going to get done anyway.
That's right. Oh, you are just such, well, I love you just to know that you're doing that. For me, you know who I am. You know, I'm everywhere, all over the place, all the time. I want to shout out to Sam Hassan, LA Talk Radio. Thank you for being my friend. And wonderful things that LA Talk Radio does. We have a great list of show hosts. I also want to give a shout out to you, my luminaries out there. I love you. I love you for who you are, what you stand for every day, looking in the mirror, facing yourself with honesty, integrity, and getting it done. And also, I like you for staying true to the world and having a mission such as Professor Manu, having a mission and sticking to that mission and also getting that done. Don't let anything get in the way or distract you. You know, any negatives. If you need positive, go on, listen to this interview and you'll hear what this man is out here doing on his own. And then I want to say, please, above all, on our show, like, ta-da-da. Share, woo, and subscribe, my pretty little bright looms and luminaries out there. Don't forget that without your support, I cannot do it. I can do it alone, but I'd rather do it with you. So if you want to get out there and help us come along with supporting Professor Manu's projects, it would be very, very welcome. And finally, and most importantly, don't forget to smile. It does work wonders, believe it or not. Even if people don't smile back, smiling, it brightens up a whole room just to see you smile just like that. And we'll see you next week with another topic. Anything else you want to say, Professor Manu, before we get out of here?
Thank you for the opportunity, Ms. Osiris. I appreciate connecting with your audience. So thank you for your ongoing work as well.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. We'll see you all next week. Bye.
You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.